On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Game 7 of the World Series was one of the best baseball games of all time. I am often overly hyperbolic. It is one of my worst qualities as a person alongside not texting people back. But in saying that, I feel confident that it was one of the best baseball games of all time. I was there. I saw it. Jordan Schusterman, he was there. He saw it. We saw it together. And now you will hear us talk about it at 4 a.m. in the morning. Well, you won't be at 4 a.m. You get my point. Hello and welcome to the only baseball podcast in the world recording at 4:20 in the morning after Game 7 of the World Series. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. We are both emotional messes. We are thunderstorms of tumult. We are spent, empty, exhausted, and we didn't even play.
I am so grateful to have witnessed what we saw tonight here. This morning, yesterday, what day is it? What year is it? What month is it? This has been a long couple weeks for us following this sport and what it has given us. And I am still truly in shock at 95 different things that happened in this Game 7 of the World Series. And it's a shame because Game 6, pretty freaking good. Not even going to talk about it.
Didn't even think about that.
We had made the decision that we were only going to podcast if the Blue Jays had won Game 6, and we weren't going to try and squeeze one in to set up a Game 7. And, you know, there's like a 2% of me that regrets that, because obviously Game 6 was very special in and of its own right. But Jake Mintz, Game 7 gave us a lifetime's worth of baseball memories. And I guess we'll do the opener, Game 7 of the World Series.
Now, that is fitting because Game 7 kind of did have an opener. And that's where we'll begin, with Shohei Ohtani, who began Game 7 on the mound for one reason. Well, many reasons. He is good at pitching. That is a reason that he pitched. But the main reason he began the night as the starting pitcher is rule-related. The regulations regarding movement between designated hitter and pitcher stipulate that an Ohtani, we'll just call it that because it's about him, an Ohtani can go from starter to DH. But if Ohtani starts the game at DH, he cannot go and relieve as a pitcher and then return to DH. The Dodgers would lose the DH spot in that circumstance, and therefore Ohtani started on the mound. And what we learned almost right away is that he didn't have his best stuff. He survives through the first two innings with a lot of traffic, and his best stuff is still pretty damn good. It's better than my best stuff. But it wasn't as sharp from a command perspective as we're used to with Shohei.
Yeah, I think that is a very fair way to say it. He looks pretty tired, which you can imagine after all he has done for this team this season, this postseason, this series. He is human, believe it or not, and he does look pretty tired. And while I will make jokes at Shohei's expense later on in this recap, when I shame him for his pitching performance based on how his pal Yoshinobu Yamamoto did on 0 days rest, I will, of course, point out, and as everyone knows, that Shohei has been plenty busy rounding the bases, taking at bats, swinging the bat very hard, and doing so much else, in between his last start. So he has a great excuse to be pretty tired at this point in the season.
The best.
And I think that the best excuse. And I think that the Dodgers were pretty realistic about what they were going to get from Ohtani in this one. But the reality is we can just zoom ahead to the bottom of the third. We're going to get to Max Scherzer in a second. One big swing here, a swing that we will still probably remember for a very long time. Of course, not one that ends up contributing to the final result. But Shohei, they do leave him in there to face the top of the order for a second time. And Bo Bichette makes him pay with one of the most incredible swings we've ever seen. A first pitch slider, I believe, or sweeper that he just destroys from Shohei after he had intentionally walked Vlad Jr. To you know, because he'd rather face Bo, and Bo made him pay. And it was wow, what a freaking swing that was.
It was the second longest home run that Ohtani has ever allowed as a major leaguer, 442 feet. I'm thankful for that distance because there was no doubt, right? This was not a wall scraper. This was not Davis Schneider getting lucky off of Blake Snell or whatever. The distance with which Bo hit this ball enabled the moment to breathe as it deserved to. He got to walk to first, which was, I am sure, nice for his bum knee. He got to milk it. We got to know. The crowd got to explode immediately. There was no holding your breath. There was no wondering if. It was just wow. And for Bo to have that moment, a player who has been with this team in this organization since 2016 when they drafted him as a teenager, whose contract is now, I guess next week, expired. He will be a free agent. To battle through the knee injury that kept him out for the first rounds of these playoffs. And he has come up big in this World Series before. He has had some huge moments, most notably in game three when he drives Vlad in with that ball down the right field line before it devolves into 18 innings of madness. This was supreme. It was superb. It was as enthralling and thrilling of a baseball moment that I have seen in person, up there with the Aaron Judge homer, honestly, earlier this year, up there with the Bryce Harper homer to send the Phillies to the World Series. But given the circumstances, given the stakes, game seven of the World Series, I will never forget it. And the result of this game, spoilers, the Dodgers won, the result of this game won't ruin that for me, and I certainly hope it doesn't ruin that for Jays fans.
Two more things on Bo, and then we'll pivot to the Jays starter, Max Scherzer. Max Scherzer started this game. He's 41. He started this game. He was pretty good.
He started two World Series games and was the story 0% in both of them.
Okay, so you're getting to what I was about to say, but the last thing I'll say about Bo is, I mean, listen, we talk about that guy for a long time, but I mean, he hadn't homered in 2 months, right? You know, he'd had some big hits since he came back, clearly still hampered by that injury. He's just such a special hitter that he's been able to just kind of slap the ball around the yard. He hasn't had very many extra base hits or like high impact exit velocity. Like, he's just been finding hits in ways that Bo Bichette has done for his entire career. There's a reason this guy led the league in hits twice. There's a reason he was going to do it again this year if he didn't get injured. But to have a swing of power like that in that spot was amazing. That said, as excited as we were when that happened because of just like how cool it was the third inning. And this just kind of brings up a theme that I was thinking about going into this game that I think I said to you, and as we bring Max Scherzer in as a main character here, which is that the stage that we had, you know, was being set with Scherzer versus Ohtani was amazing and is worth marveling over for sure. But I always knew, and it was clear that like so much is going to happen. I didn't know this much. So much is going to happen after these guys leave the game, that it's difficult for me to imagine that either of them is going to be the story. And that ended up being true. But before we say goodbye to Max Scherzer as a character, we do have to point out the fact that this dude pitched into the fifth inning when no one thought he would make it past the second or the third. And what, that is
he shouldn't
an astonishing
have made it past the fourth.
Yeah, sure.
I would like to talk about the fourth inning. which was the first moment of this game where I was like, is anyone else watching what we're watching? So Scherzer comes back out after the Jays score, right, in the bottom of the third, after the Bo homer. He comes out the top of the fourth and does not look good. Will Smith starts the inning off with a ringing double. Freeman singles, moving Smith to third. And Mookie's coming up and Muncy's on deck. And we're like, Scherzer should not be facing Muncy, let alone Mookie. He does. He gets Mookie to pop out weakly to center field, though Addison Barger caught it because he has a better arm than Dalton Varsho, whose very bad arm had a memorable night, at least in my mind. And then he stays in to face Muncy, who he walks. And at this point, we're like, base is loaded, one out. Max Scherzer, heck of a run. Like, you're 41. Tip your cap. Let's go. And neither pitching coach Pete Walker nor skipper John Schneider move a frickin' muscle. And it's Scherzer, bases loaded, one out. And you're like, one swing from Teo, who is completely capable of one swing. And the Dodgers are winning. Basically immediately making all of the magic of the Bo homer irrelevant. And instead, you get sack fly, the least fly sack fly ever. It was a sack laser directly to Dalton Varsho. He extends fully forward, dives, catches it, runs, scores. And then to finish the inning, still Max Scherzer, Tommy Edman lines a ball into fair territory that Vlad goes full extension, catches to end the frame. And you're like, escape. Like, Scherzer should not have survived that. I can't believe he did. And then he comes back out for the fifth.
So quickly before we get to the fifth, I do think on replay the Edman ball is, I think, foul, which in some ways makes the catch even more amazing. But on Teo, like you're saying, oh, Teo could hit a grand slam here. If Varsho misses that ball, I mean, three runs are scoring easily. Like, that is a hard sinking liner that requires one of the best center fielders in baseball with the guts to dive on a ball that is sinking. Because that's getting to the fence, you know, maybe Teo doesn't come all the way around. But that play, even though it's still early, felt just huge, even though, to your point, a run scores. And as we know, everyone was very important here. But yes, no, of course, it was just like, okay, well, that's clearly it. But it was the bottom of the order. And so with that in mind, okay, now bottom of the fourth. I mean, I don't really have that much to say about this other than, like, I can't believe we saw the benches clear in Game 7 of the World Series.
That was the fourth?
So Justin Wroblewski, right? Isn't that mind-blowing? So Justin Wroblewski is in the game at this point, having replaced Ohtani, and he hits Andrés Giménez with a pitch, and Giménez doesn't like it. Wroblewski very reasonably is like, I wasn't trying to hit you. Why would I be trying to hit the nine-hitter in Game 7?
In Game 7 of the World Series.
With George Springer on deck.
I will say, that was not the language he used. And this is, you know, what happens in these situations when tension is afoot and emotions are running high is, like, if you're Giménez and there are two pitches in the at-bat, plate appearance, that fly up and in under your hands, you are understandably peeved when the ball hits you in the hand, right? And then when Wroblewski goes, I didn't try to hit you, MF-er, that's not exactly de-escalation. And so then it just all pops off. Obviously wasn't trying to hit him. I understand when the hitter's mad. And then, yeah, just benches clearing Game 7 of the World Series is something we'll never forget. Trey is Savage giggling as he runs in because he had never gotten to do a benches clearing situation in his life because he literally just got here. Louis Varland, who is warming up, who has pitched in 15 of the 18 Jays playoff games, being way behind everyone else because he was getting loose. Tyler Glasnow exiting from the Dodgers side when the whole world knew that he was going to have to, like, come in later in that inning. It was fascinating to see. Did it play a role in this game? Thankfully not. And I think that's a good thing when it's all said and done. Jordan, I think we should take a break here. We still have a lot to get to, but it feels like a nice stopping point for our first nap. We'll talk to you in a second. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Game 7 of the World Series happened. The Dodgers won it. The Blue Jays lost it. If you were just listening to us, which you probably were because it's the middle of the show, it is now the bottom of the fourth inning. Not right now, but in our retelling of the tale. And I think from here, we can fast forward to the top of the sixth, right?
Yeah, I mean, Scherzer does come out. Varland comes in, as you mentioned, for the 15th time, a major league record, 15th time appearing in the postseason. All kinds of records being set. My goodness, the Blue Jays play a lot of baseball in this postseason. But Glasnow's in for Wroblewski. Varland is in for Scherzer. And Glasnow gets through the fifth unscathed. And now we have Chris Bassitt. Now this is where the Dodgers are just clawing back slowly, slowly, slowly. We get a run against Bassitt on a sac fly in the sixth. We go to the bottom of the sixth. And this is the moment that I really kind of focused on in my story. Because this is where it really felt like, oh my God, the Blue Jays are going to win the World Series. Yes, there were many innings left to go. But when Ernie Clement leaves off with his 29th hit of the postseason, he steals second base and scores on Andrés Giménez's RBI double and comes around third, throws off his helmet, slides into home, smiling as wide of a smile as you'll ever see a baseball player while they're playing baseball. That makes it 4-2 Toronto. And it was like, we just got a run. You know, the Dodgers had scored the previous inning. It was like, we get that run back. We've got this two-run cushion. We can see it. We can taste it. 9 outs away.
They have a runner on second.
Ready to go.
With nobody out.
So that's true. They have a runner on second with nobody out. That's true. This is a good point.
And the top of the order coming up.
This is where
they got one insurance run and they, in theory, should be able to get another one across with the top of the order. And that's not how it goes. Glasnow buckles down, gets Springer swinging. Lucas lines out sharply to center field. And Vlad grounds out to end the inning. 4-2, Jays.
But in the top of the seventh, we have another moment where it's like, all right, even if it's getting a little dicey and the Dodgers are getting feisty here, this still feels like the Jays are going to do it. Trey Savage comes in. Oh, my God. Again, like, it's so funny because we're building towards this Yamamoto appearance, which is just infinitely more ridiculous than everything every other pitcher did. But again, your Savage coming into this spot, for all we've talked about him this month, is also amazing. So here comes Trey Savage, and he walks Shohei Ohtani to start the inning. And you're like, oh, boy.
Fair.
Yikes. Will Smith.
He walks Shohei relatively non-competitively. Like his third pitch of the at-bat goes to the backstop, right? He gets a strike in there, but you're like, your Savage
doesn't look great. Doesn't. But after Will Smith flies out, Freddie grounds into a double play. Vlad, just what a defensive showcase for him this month on top of having one of the greatest offensive postseasons ever.
That's a sentence, but it is.
It's true. He snags it, fires it over to second, back to him at first to get out of it. And like at that point, so this is maybe a question. So like, as you mentioned, your Savage does not look good. At this point, they have 6 outs to get. Did you think that he was going to come back out? So the Blue Jays do not score in the seventh. Emmett Sheehan's on, who I had like completely forgotten about as even remotely relevant to any of this pitching plan. Credit to him. Kind of important. But anyway, we go to the top of the eighth.
I'll take this moment quickly here. You look at the final box score. The Dodgers got 5 outs from Sheehan and Wroblewski. That's super important, right?
Enormous.
That's super important. And you don't notice it, right, as it's happening, because not every inning can make you want to vomit. Some of them just have to be filler. But like Wroblewski and Sheehan. Only most of them doing the filler innings. Like that's kind of a big deal. And so when your Savage comes out, right, when he comes out for the eighth, like it's an interesting decision. The ideal situation here is you have your Savage go for the eighth and then Hoffman comes out for the ninth. Right? You're going to have to face Ohtani one more time. You want that to be Hoffman. So Savage comes out and he kind of looks better, right? Like he looks okay. The first batter he faces is Mookie and he like gets him calm, like cleanly, right? And you're like, oh, maybe Trey's locked in. But the problem with a guy like Trey Savage, who is amazing and incredible, is when you're living and dying with the splitter, the worst version of a splitter is the worst pitch in the world. It really is. When you leave it up doesn't dance and it's elevated, and maybe it's just how it looks, right? Like maybe it's a visual thing. But when you leave a bad splitter up, it's batting practice. And you know who doesn't miss batting practice? Max Muncy.
And here's the tragedy of this. I would imagine that part of the thinking of leaving him in is because of that splitter, and I know Hoffman has a splitter too, but like you actually maybe want him more against Muncy than maybe Hoffman.
The lefty.
Yep. In that case, right? Because these reverse splits has been good against lefty hitters. And, you know, the slider was clearly on enough to get Mookie. So credit to him. But as you said, I mean, the splitter to Muncy is just as bad as it gets, which is tough, right? This game's not on, as we know, this game is not on any one person on the Blue Jays because there were a lot of things that ultimately it came up short and pitches that were poorly thrown, whatever. So anyway,
Muncy bomb. Man,
yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. But hey, they have the cushion. Muncy, they still got the lead.
Sure. 5-3. Muncy goes deep. Savage gets Teoscar to ground out, and in comes Jeff Hoffman for the final out of the inning to get Tommy Edman. If you're going to chalk talk decisions here, this is a point where I think you can be a little critical. Like, at this point, you're asking Hoffman to do an up-down, right? Which turns out to certainly be relevant. Now, what would you have done instead? Would you leave Savage in against Edman? Edmund's probably not taking him deep, right? You would think. And so then if you really needed Hoffman, go get Dominguez to try and finish the inning and then you have Hoffman for the ninth? Mm-hmm. Like there are other ways to do this. I don't think it's like a fireable offense. Obviously, John Schneider was great generally this October. This is just a point where you could be picky if you wanted to. But let's move on to the top of the bottom of the eighth, which is relevant because of how long it takes. Emmett Sheehan starts the inning. Ernie Clement rips a double. Place is going ballistic. In comes Blake Snell. Blake Snell then is not beating the diva allegations. He, I think, more than any player is like going to be hated in Toronto forever, even like more than Ohtani, for the combo of like the lucky discourse. And then tonight, asking the grounds crew to repair the mound in the middle of the eighth inning of Game 7 of the World Series. It is his right. The landing spot was not to his liking. That's fine. You can both say he's allowed to do that and also slightly roll your eyes at it a little bit. But that extra time pays off. Snell escapes the inning. He gets an Andrés Giménez line out on a bunt play. This is a moment I totally forgot about. Giménez squares to bunt to move Clement over to third. He slashes
crazy
and just hits it right at Muncy. Like as hard as Andrés Giménez playing like very far in. Like Muncy could have lost teeth, you know, if this goes another way. 96 miles an hour, and Muncy is playing 73 feet from home plate. Right. So that's 17 feet in front of the bag. And it goes right to him. And you're like, wowza, right? It's an unbelievable catch. Snell buckles down. After that, he gets Davis Schneider and George Springer swinging to finish the frame. And at this point, not to be like, oh, I'm a ball knower, in my notebook, I wrote, long time for Jeff Hoffman to be sitting between innings. And it was.
It sure was. And, they would strand more runners later, but spoiler alert, 3-for-17 with runners in scoring position for Toronto.
Oof.
That is really, really painful. And that's, of course, an easy stat to throw out in any big game. But when sure. when a lot of these were in the last, you know, four or five innings, you really felt that. And stranding the leadoff double there was killer. But as you mentioned, Jeff Hoffman goes back out. And he's got three outs to get. And what is so incredible about this inning is that there's only one thing we're thinking about. And let me tell you, it ain't Miguel Rojas.
It's not Miguel Rojas.
All we're looking at is that, oh my God, is Shohei Ohtani going to be the last out of the World Series? This guy who finally, at long last, seemed to be defeated. Him, his hands on his knees after allowing that bow home run. And yes, he got to stay in the game and keep hitting. Yeah.
Through my binoculars, I can't remember what inning this was. You know, it was before the ninth. I was looking in the Dodgers dugout just to see, is Ohtani watching the bottom of the eighth? And no, he was in the tunnel doing whatever. And then he like walks up the stairs, like the dugout steps. You know, when you like, maybe you go for a really long hike and let's say you go for a really long hike and you're really exhausted and you go home, you live on the second floor of an apartment and you walk up those stairs and your legs feel like lead and you're just like slowly like pulling yourself up. And you're like almost, you know, when you have to like bounce on a stair on your leg and then like propel yourself up. Like Ohtani was doing that to get up the stairs. And I'm like, my God, he's going to hit again. He's going to tie this game. But he's not the hero. Miguel freaking Rojas is. And let's introduce this character. For those of you unfamiliar with Miguel Rojas, like veteran grinder, okay? He is 36 years old, I believe. He does not play a whole lot. He can fake it at shortstop. He can play second base. He cannot hit right-handed pitching. He's pretty good against lefties, and he did not start any of these World Series games until game six, where he was thrown into the lineup by Dave Roberts because he added a little bit of edge. He had phenomenal at-bats and made an incredible pick to end game six, which is not a game we're talking about on this episode, and therefore was in the lineup again. And so when he's up with a 3-2 count against Jeff Hoffman with one out after Kike strikes out to start the frame, you're like, he's just going to put it in play. A 3-2 count, really, against Hoffman at that spot, if he strikes out, it's already a win just because you're sucking up pitches before Ohtani. He put a great at-bat together. He's just trying to put bat on ball. And instead, he delivers the swing of his life. Hoffman throws a slider that backs up. Rojas turns on it and hits it out over the fence. A Jays fan reaches down and catches it and is like excited about catching a ball at the World Series for like 0.3 seconds and then remembers the context and then immediately is downtrodden. This was one of the most shocking baseball things I have ever seen in person. If you had drafted players least likely to hit a game-tying home run on these two rosters, he's probably my third-to-last pick behind Miles Straw and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. This was unbelievable. This was unbelievable.
Again, there were a lot of moments that made us just lose it in the press box as professionally as possible. Which honestly really started again. Sorry, I know we didn't do a full episode on it, but just like the end of game six, I was unbelievable. But anyway, back to Rojas. One of the things I was thinking about as he was coming up, obviously he had earned this playing time, but also I was like, man, like the Dodgers bench is so bad that like they ain't pinch hitting for Miguel Rojas in this spot with like a lefty or something, you know? It's like, no. This guy's our best option who going into Saturday hadn't had a hit in a month because he hadn't started any games. I believe he had a hit against the Reds, but he'd barely played. He, as you pointed out, had not homered against an actual right-handed pitcher. As we found out, his one homer against the right-handed pitcher this year was against the position player, the catcher, Logan Porter. But to your point, right, you're just hoping you're getting an at-bat that's grinding Hoffman down. Maybe he can, you know, line a single or something or draw a walk. this was stunning. And honestly, it was also kind of a no-doubter. I mean, it was a doubter because you couldn't fathom that he had even elevated the ball with force.
Right.
But like, we all pretty much realized what had happened when he made contact. And yeah, I mean, this is, again, this is, it's, you know, 5 a.m. and we're just throwing stuff out. This kind of feels like the Rajay Davis home run, except day one.
Yes. Yes.
That's really the only thing I can think of. And that is just, that's unbelievable. That's that as we still talk about the Rajay homer and they lost, right? And this was that. He is the story. We'll get to Yamamoto here in a bit. Now again, Ohtani then comes up, hits the ball pretty freaking hard. He hits one to the warning track. Jeff Hoffman strikes out Will Smith. Will Smith would be just fine. He'll come up again later. And oh my God. So tie game. We go to the bottom of the ninth. Jake Mintz, let's take a break. And when we return,
sure, man.
Three of the most absurd innings, if we haven't gotten crazy enough, three of the most absurd innings, I guess two and a half of the most absurd innings of our lives. We'll be right back. Baseball Park fans. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We continue our recap. Game 7 of the World Series. That is what this episode is really going to be, because if you're listening to this hoping for big picture discourse about what it means for the Dodgers to win another World Series, we might sneak in some of those thoughts at the end, but to be honest, that will probably come later this week when we have slept. So let's continue on with our game recap. Because this game was not over. The Blue Jays still had a tremendous chance to win this baseball game. Multiple times, actually. As we go to the bottom of the ninth with the heart of the order coming up. And who is pitching at this point? I've lost track.
For the who?
For the Dodgers.
Blake Snell, but it's soon to not be.
Blake Snell starts the inning.
And this,
Blake Snell starts the
inning. He starts the inning. Bichette single, Addison Barger walk. Snell's out of bullets effectively. And out from the bullpen comes Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who threw 96 pitches the day before. Threw 6 innings in game 6. He threw 9 innings in game 2. And when Dave Roberts was asked about his availability last night, Dave Roberts basically said, everyone is available, but no, not Yoshinobu Yamamoto. Now, in our reporting after the game, talking to people, that seemed to change overnight as Yamamoto and his guru got after it late, it seems, to put him in the best position to pitch today. And when he woke up, he felt good. Now, Dodgers officials, coaches, did not believe that he was actually going to be able to pitch today until they saw him play catch. When he threw on the field before the game, it was coming out as good as it usually comes out, and he was added to the pitching plan. Now, the plan is in quotes because he doesn't end up pitching in this game until the bottom of the ninth inning with the game tied. So there are a million different directions that, you know, game 7 could have gone in which Yamamoto doesn't see the field. That's not what happened. 0 days rest, for those of you who've never pitched before, is the equivalent of not sleeping, like doing a full night where you don't sleep, like we're doing right now, and then trying to function normally the next day at work, where you just feel like your limbs aren't talking to one another and you're a half step behind. You're almost on like a tape delay living your, like that's pitching on no day's rest as a starter. It does not happen for a reason. Yamamoto, what he did tonight was the single most impressive pitching feat that we've seen, right? Like, I know he wasn't as sharp as he has been. But the fact that he was able to roll out there and throw 2 2/3, I'm floored.
I mean, his worst pitch of the night was basically his first one, or I guess second one, right? Because remember how this starts. He comes in with first and second and one out, and he hits Alejandro Kirk. And you're like, oh my God, this is a catastrophe. And if the Blue Jays walk off and win the World Series against Yamamoto on no day's rest, no one's going to be mad at Yamamoto. It's just going to be like this unbelievable finish that he was the one that they turned to, right? And that is sure what it seemed to be heading towards, as the bases were then loaded with one out in a tie game. It's right there. The winning, the World Series winning run is right there on third base in the form of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who had entered earlier in the inning as a pinch runner for Bo Bichette, who had singled. Now, when that happened, many of us turned to each other and kind of were like, are we sure we want to take Bo out of a game? We just watched this in game 3. Do we want to take Bo out of a game that could be going into extra innings? And Bo clearly couldn't run. And so clearly they made the decision that this was a calculated risk, that yes, we need to put someone that can advance multiple bases, which is the real sad irony here, because Kiner-Falefa only needed to advance one base. Now, obviously, while we know he was out in the play we are about to describe,
Bo's out
he gets
by
there faster than Bo would have.
An hour.
Bo's out by a lot more. But in some ways, that would have been less painful than
easier
what happens here. So
I
know you have a lot. I know you have a lot of thoughts about this play. So go ahead, because Dalton Varshow is batting now with one out and the bases loaded, and IKF is on third base. So what happens next?
So he chops one to second. Miguel Rojas wrangles it and throws home and gets the force a half step ahead of Kiner-Falefa, who slides in feet first. Now that's the SparkNotes version of the play, right? And it's inches. Let me just back up a half second. Like, I think Isaiah Kiner-Falefa is deserving of blame in this spot. I think that blame, when it comes to just like the way people interact with players now, is really toxic. And like, he should not be the recipient of that type of vitriol. It is a sport. Do not threaten people. He's still at fault here in my eyes. I think the issue, there are two problems here. One is sliding into home. Okay. Sliding slows you down. Why is he sliding? He should be treating home like first base, in the same way that we often see runners on like a inning ending force play at second run through the back. There's no reason for him to slide. He's not sliding around a tag. He's not sliding to stop his momentum. He should be running right through the base or going head first, which is in this circumstance faster than sliding. Like, he should be just diving, right? That's mistake number one. The bigger mistake, and the reason he even has to be in that spot, is because he does not give himself enough of a lead at third base. Now, whether that is IKF's fault or that is the fault of the third base coach, I don't know, right? There's a chance the third base coach is saying, hey, I need you a little closer here to third. I need one back from you. I didn't see what IKF said after the game, but whatever mechanisms led to that point are wrong. And I know that some people online, including some current players, have said, well, what if he gets back picked? What if there's a line drive? That is all true. The odds of there being a line drive right at a guy, even though we did just see it with Jimenez, are statistically lower than there being an infield ground ball that leads to a play at home. Even if you're going to say he's got to be closer, he does not need to be that close. He can get as far off as Muncy gives him, and another step and a half, and the Blue Jays win the World Series. It is a painful reality. I wish that wasn't the case for Jays fans, but that's a fact. And I had multiple people, like I tweeted something that kind of sneaky blew up about this with the high home shot. And I had like multiple people from smart baseball organizations being like, you are correct. This is not on IKF necessarily, but it is on the communication and the strategy here between him and the third base coach.
Yes. And I just sent you what IKF said after the game about this, which is essentially validating your perspective in terms of him being told what to do. He's basically talked about how they said to stay close to the bag so as to avoid the back pick, to avoid getting doubled off. But I agree with your point that, again, when you consider the circumstances, the risk reward there is very different. And when you can be that much closer to the World Series winning run, that hurts. I think if you're really ranking,
they still could have won. Yeah. If you're ranking tough to swallow, I think this is one for Jays fans, even more than the Hoffman homer, which is kind of wild because this is not a failure of skill. This is a failure of execution and fundamentals. Like I would have given up a home run in that spot to Jeff Hoffman, or excuse me, to Miguel Rojas, because I suck. I could have stood at third base in theory and been like, hey, I need one more off the bag. You see what I'm saying? Like, sure. Maybe I'm oversimplifying this and it is 5 a.m.
No, I'm
not as good at coaching as the Jays third base coach, but I think that is what makes that so hard. And yet, it almost doesn't matter. It almost doesn't matter because Ernie Clement crushes one deep into the left center field gap. Andy Pages in center and Kike Hernandez in left give chase. Now, Andy Pages had only come into this game this inning, okay? This inning is a defensive replacement.
Not just this inning. Not just this inning. In the middle of the inning, he did not come in to start the inning. He came in when Kirk got plunked and it was bases loaded, one out, essentially to throw someone out at home in the case of a sac fly. That's why he came in the game. Now, you could argue he should have been in the game an inning earlier or at the start of the inning for defensive purposes, whatever. But this is not just the start of the inning. This is like you were in here for this exact moment, but it was definitely more so for the arm than it was for the range. However, he ranges back. He crashes into Kike Hernandez. And it's a good thing that Pages is a big, strong dude, because I think if Tommy Edman tries to make this catch, either he doesn't get there and doesn't make the play, or him and Kike collide and the force of each other basically ruins both of their chances of catching it, and the Blue Jays win the World Series. Instead, Pages just truck sticks Kike and is like, I'm the center fielder. I got this. And I
Kike
think
Hernandez
Kike
got
a little bit
jacked
of,
up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you do have to give Kike a little bit of credit because he did seem to defer at the last second. Pages reaches up, makes the grab. Kike falls down. I haven't seen him talk about this yet, whether he didn't know if he caught it or not when he was face first in the dirt or in the turf.
So I talked to a friend of the program, Alden Gonzalez, who writes ESPN. It is in Alden's story. Okay. I'm just going to read. This is amazing. Hernandez and Pages, who had just been inserted into the game for his arm strength, converged. In the end, Hernandez went down. His face was buried in the warning track. Behind him, he thought the ball had fallen in and that the game was over. Quote, it's from Hernandez. I was going to pull a Willie Mays, and then he tackled me. I felt like I got dunked on, and I thought we lost. I was just down because I thought we lost. And he came up to me and said, are you okay? I said, F that. Do you have the ball? He's like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, let's go.
I mean, that's what it looked like.
Yeah. Are you okay?
Oh, my goodness.
Are we still playing baseball?
Oh. All right. So
incredible. Incredible. It's so good.
We like, again, there was 1.7 seconds tonight where I was like, did Ernie Clement just hit a walk-off grand slam to win the World Series? unfortunately, that's not what happened. Top of the 10th. Actually, let's fly through the 10th. 10th is important just because the Dodgers then have bases loaded, one out, and they don't score. Sir Anthony Dominguez. God bless him.
Yamamoto. Bottom of the 10th. Yamamoto cruises. I threw yesterday.
He strikes out. He goes 3-0 on Springer, and then is like, "Wait a minute,
I got this."
Sorry about that, guys.
ISO.
I got this. We're good. ISO. We're ISO. Perfect cutter. Perfect splitter. Perfect splitter. Perfect splitter. Goodbye, George Springer. Have a nice night. Miles Straw is in the game.
He won't.
Not gonna do anything against Yoshinobu Yamamoto. We go to the top 11th. Here comes Shane Bieber. Oh, gosh. All right. So, based on the deployment of the pitchers by Toronto, it is fair to say that Shane Bieber was not considered plan A.
Yes.
That's
especially
a fact,
compared to what we're here in the 11th inning. Thought heading into this game. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. And that could be for a few reasons. The fact that they had already pushed him back, that even amidst this postseason run, they have been cognizant of this is still someone 18 months removed from surgery who is also approaching free agency. And like, it's not like Shane Bieber doesn't want to pitch and doesn't want to help the Blue Jays win the World Series, but like, this is still a pitcher to be careful with relative to some of the other pitchers that they have for different contextual reasons. But also, Shane Bieber, his gift and his talents are not necessarily the kind that would play up in a relief role. Shane Bieber is not going to come in throwing 99 or maxing out throwing the nastiest splitters and the nastiest sliders and just, you know, in the way that a Glasnow or a Snell, you know, or even a Savage or a Gossman like we saw in Game 7, you know, last round. The profile is not for this situation. But he's still Shane Bieber. He's a really good pitcher. And so with the bottom of the order coming up, with Miguel Rojas coming up and then the top of the order coming up, they go to Bieber in the top of the 11th. He gets Rojas to ground out. He gets Ohtani to ground out. God, I forgot this was with two outs. Oh, my goodness. And he gets 2-0 to Will Smith. And he just hangs a slider, basically the same pitch that Hoffman made to a way better hitter. And Will Smith just ain't going to miss this pitch. He's just not going to miss it.
And no, he's not.
And he basically hit the exact home run that he hit in game two, right? It looked pretty much identical.
Yeah.
To the one he hit off Gossman to kind of give the Dodgers that win. And this was another just breathtaking swing. Yet another one in this game, and it's crushing for Bieber for sure. And Will Smith was another reminder of like, oh yep, this guy's. We always refer to the Hall of Famers, the three Hall of Famers, the MVPs. Stu might be a Hall of Famer too. It's true, he might be. And we gloss over him because he's
ever.
That's very true. We gloss over him because he's Will Smith and he doesn't have a lot to say and. He doesn't exactly lose personality, but you cannot deny
good
this dude is a freaking unbelievable ball
player.
There's a reason that the Dodgers are like, let's have Will Smith hit instead of Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman. That's a choice that they made, and it was the right one because Will Smith
feels relevant.
Won the Dodgers the World Series.
Yeah, I mean, what a player. He is not enjoyable to craft narratives around because he does not lend himself to them. That is not his job. His job is to hit the smithereens out of stuff, and he does that.
And catches every inning of the World Series. Every inning.
He's amazing. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable swing from an unbelievable hitter. We head to the bottom of the ninth. Well, I'm so tired.
11.
We head to the bottom of the 11th. We head to the bottom of the 11th.
Almost done.
We go to the airport. Head to bottom of the 11th. Yamamoto's still out there. And here comes Vladdy. Oh, dude, I forgot a Vladdy moment from earlier. There was I think it was in the ninth when Vladdy hit the ball to the wall. And it was like, are we going to get the Vladdy walk-off homer? That was just people wanting to believe what was happening instead of like him actually hitting a homer. Anyway, whatever. Vladdy leads off the bottom of the 11th. Laser beam double. Runner in scoring position. Tying runner at second base. Here we go. Next move. IKF sack bunt moves Vlad over to third. For the people online who are like, I can't believe they gave away an out here. you did not watch Isaiah Kiner-Falefa hit this postseason, respectfully. That is a relevant thing. When you decide whether to bunt a guy to give up an out, you have to involve in that calculation the skill set and the ability of the player hitting. IKF in this spot was a low probability knock. And I think giving away an out to put Vlad in scoring position with one out is completely defensible. That's my two cents. I'm curious for your thoughts.
Totally. Just glad he didn't pop it up. I was like, he was perfect bunt. Perfect bunt. Did his job. And you're trying to keep this game alive and continue forward. Asking him to get a hit there is not realistic. So, yes, fine. Yamamoto then walks.
Addison Barger walks. Addison Barger, who, by the way, we should have talked about four pitches. Addison Barger,
who I'm like, about Barger?
I just think he's amazing. What a good player. Awesome. I'm going to rank him way too high on whatever heading into next season. Like, he's a freaking awesome player. So he walks on four pitches, runners on the corners with one out. And at this point, Jordan.
Again, like, he walks him on four pitches, four straight splitters. And it's like, okay, is Yamamoto, like, is he running out here? Like, is this the part where the guy that pitched yesterday is, like, kind of losing it?
Could be.
By the way, let's also mention that at some point during this inning, Roki Sasaki and Clayton Kershaw are warming.
Clayton Kershaw fantasy camp begins.
When they announced that. Oh, my God. Anyway, but they stick with Yamamoto. With one out and runners on the corners. And a day after, he had made Kirk look so bad. Game six. Yeah. He gets him quickly to 0-2. Fouls off a cutter. Lands a curveball. And then...
you know what I'm just realizing right now?
I mean, excuse me? Yeah.
Did you know Ha-Seong Kim was in this game? You know he played tonight?
Yes, he came in for defense because Rojas apparently got injured. Apparently Rojas totally had some sort of flare-up. Yeah.
I'm literally watching the clip of the final play of the game, which is, by the way, Mookie Betts fields the Kirk grounder, steps on second, fires for his Dodgers in the World Series. And as I'm watching him like roll over to second, Ha-Seong Kim is running to second base. I'm like, where is he? I did not at any point clock that he played in this game, but good for him. Holy crap.
His first appearance of the World Series.
Unreal. Unreal. But Mookie, man. Mookie, it is fitting that this is how it is.
Oh, for sure.
Mookie Betts. Hate the Dodgers all you want. I think that, like there is a healthy amount of sports hate that one should and can hold for this franchise right now. What that means for the state of the game and the economics is a conversation for another day. Even if you think that, like, the Dodgers are not bad for baseball, you can still hate them as, like, a dynasty. That's what makes sports fun, right? Do they make you feel helpless sometimes? Yes. A level of that is interesting and compelling. How much? That we'll talk about later this week, okay? But Mookie Betts moving to shortstop and probably winning a Gold Glove, I hope, is something that we can all, from San Francisco to Houston to Toronto, agree is unbelievable. And for the Dodgers season to end with him making this relatively routine but incredibly athletic play where he steps on second, jumps over the runner, and throws to first in one smooth motion. Beautiful. Beautiful way for it to go.
Yeah, it was. It was a, this was not, you know, a foul out.
No.
You know, you think about what the last out's going to look like. And as painful as it is to say, I was thinking about the walk-off to win the World Series, right? Multiple times during this game. But you know, once the Dodgers finally got that lead, you are wondering, and once we realize that it's just going to be Yamamoto, whether they win or lose, you're wondering what that last out's going to be. And for Yamamoto to perfectly, you know, coax that double play is just freaking unbelievable. I mean, we got to go. I got to go for sure. There's so much more to say about a lot of the main characters on this team and what it means for the Dodgers to have won again and what it means for the Blue Jays to have come this close, what the Blue Jays, I think, proved over the course of this series, over the course of this postseason, over the course of the season, that they are a real powerhouse in baseball.
They're real boys.
They're in Toronto.
Real boys.
They have the fifth largest payroll. They got a bunch of superstars. They really, really care about. Yeah.
A lot of buildings behind me. Big city.
This is what the Blue Jays, they should be in these moments, right? And to get this close is obviously heartbreaking. But we certainly are not going to overlook this team, this franchise, this sure. group of players. As someone who, you know, covered their last 12 games up close, it really, really kind of followed them closely. Like, what an appreciation I have for John Schneider, for his coaching staff, for Vlad, for Bo, for everything. And as we know, we always say, you know, it's not going to be the same. Some of these guys will stay, some of these guys will leave. But this was absolutely a special Blue Jays team. There's a special Dodgers team, which we'll talk more about later this week. But just an all-timer, man. Just an all-freaking-timer.
If this is how a dynasty is formed, feels appropriate, feels fair, though unfair, right? Feels right. Like, the Dodgers did not steamroll this, right? They did not fluke into it. They earned every last drop of this. They did. They earned it because they played better. They earned it because they spent their, you know, gobs of money wisely. They earned it because they developed internally tons of talent, some of which contributed tonight, like Emmett Sheehan and Justin Wroblewski and Will Smith, some of which they traded away to acquire guys like Tyler Glasnow, right? And like Mookie Betts. And I think that, like, trying to strike a balance here as we cover the Dodgers, because this conversation is only going to get louder, appreciating the accomplishments of the players on this team while fairly contextualizing the institution within the current framework of our sport is really difficult and really important, because I don't think that Mookie Betts or Ohtani or Yamamoto or Glasnow or any of these guys should be viewed as like actual villains when they're going to take the money that's being paid to them and then playing as best as they can, right? And I hope that you smart listeners, you're all very intelligent, are able, and I'm sure you are, able to kind of parse those two things, right? Critique the institution, celebrate the players. That is, I guess, what maybe we will try to do. My thoughts on what the Dodgers mean for the state of baseball, to be honest with you, are not fully formed. I need a nap. I have done my best to not like think about that conversation and just appreciate what we've watched in front of us as long as I can. And that's really all I have to say about it now. The last thing I'll say before we get out of here is just like how grateful I am that I got to witness this, and how grateful I am that I get to do this for a living, how grateful I am I get to do it with you. And how cool this freaking sport is, right? I think tonight gave us baseball at its best. I kept like looking out at the crowd, and I was like looking at people clasp their hands over their nose in like this prayer formation. And I kept thinking about how many of those people don't believe in God. I know this is like nut, like kind of wacko, right? But there's like a quote that I think about where it's like, there are no atheists in foxholes. And maybe this is overly dramatic, right? But like, that's how I felt watching people watch this game. Is like, you are believing that there is a bigger thing doing this game. That is like, you are like, please, I want this to happen. Please, whether that's Dodgers fans or Blue Jays fans, right? Like, you have faith in something. You're surrendering yourself to something for the enjoyment, for the cruelty, for the wanting to vomit, all of it, right? Like, you're believing in something bigger, and like, that is the reason we get out of bed in the morning, you know? And I just thought that tonight gave us the best of the sport, a sport that I feel very grateful to cover, and I feel grateful to cover with you, who I like.
Amen, my friend. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas, the best producers around, for making this show possible into Sunday morning. I am going to attempt to go home. We will see how it goes. I have so much more to say about this game and the Dodgers and the Blue Jays.
I know.
But I got to go.
Guess what?
So thank you all for listening.
Yeah. You could talk about it later this week on Baseball Barbacast. The winter has arrived, but my dear friends, the circus rolls on. We will be recording 2 times a week all winter. Okay. Email us, baseballbarbacast.
Maybe more.
@gmail.com.
We'll see.
Maybe more.
We'll see what happens.
We love you. We hope you and you,
we will,
you know, like us.
We will talk to you later this week at some point. We appreciate everyone that listens and who has supported us all season long. It is November. It is time for me to go to sleep. But first, I must get home. Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.